This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Thursday, October 28th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, one side effect of the pandemic has been an increase in screen time, and that may be fertilizing the ecosystem of dis and misinformation. We'll hear from a leading researcher on the topic. And John Lindorf will be in the studio for Radio Nibbles. John Lindorf will be in the studio for Radio Nibbles and will be speaking with me this morning. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines, and then it's a public affair with Tish Buford. Her guest today is Teresa Gatewood, a longtime Denver resident and executive director of Creative Strategies for Change. Then at 9 a.m. comes Radio Book Club with Maeve Conran. This month's featured author is Hermione Hobie, who speaks about her latest novel, Virtue, set in the aftermath of the 2016 election. Then at 9:30, Shauna Sprawls will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. All that's still coming up, so stay tuned to your community radio station. But first, we'll start with the headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The governor's office announced yesterday the start of the I Matter program, which will offer up to 3 free mental health counseling sessions for Colorado youth age 18 and younger. Those receiving special education services are eligible up to 20 years of age. Per state law, youth 12 and older can receive counseling without parental consent. Under the program, licensed behavioral health clinicians will conduct sessions primarily via telehealth. The bipartisan legislation that created the program was signed into law earlier this year with a budget allocation of $9 million. That funding will expire June 30th of next year. According to the Denver Gazette, the State Office of Behavioral Health will provide a report on the program to the state legislature by January 1st and after the program ends. Registration for services is available online at imattercolorado.org. As homelessness continues to worsen in Metro Denver, ideas from other communities are being considered to try and help the situation. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
Researchers from CU Denver and the Common Sense Institute released a report Monday saying that expensive housing, a shortage of paid human services staff, and mistrust in the system are some of the factors making homelessness for more than 6,000 people in the 7-county metro region. The Colorado Sun reports that research also shows that homelessness worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic. The report cited Denver's Supported Housing Social Impact Bond Initiative, which has provided housing and case management services to about 300 people experiencing chronic homelessness, who were frequently involved with the police, jails, courts, and other emergency services. The people who used those services remained housed and interacted less frequently with costly emergency services. The report includes several other ideas that were identified as successful in other communities and held promise for use locally. The report found that mistrust in the system can steer some people away from accessing the services they need. One way to help is to clarify complex eligibility requirements, such as improving access to online information related to services like health, employment, housing, transportation, and financial needs. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
A federal judge has denied a preliminary injunction request made by a Roman Catholic physician and a Buddhist medical student who sought a religious exemption under a University of Colorado Anschutz medical campus vaccine policy. The Denver Gazette reports U.S. District Court Judge Raymond P. Moore issued the denial on Monday, but cautioned the university's recent revision to the mandate may bring about new arguments to the case. The revised mandate allows for religious exemptions for sincerely held religious beliefs, but not if it results in an unreasonable burden to the health and safety of others. The anonymous plaintiffs say they base their religious objections on the use of fetal cells in the development or testing of some of the COVID-19 vaccines. The university cited a 1905 U.S. Supreme Court decision that upholds compulsory vaccination laws based on public health grounds. Attorneys for the plaintiffs have indicated they intend to file an amended complaint seeking an injunction against the updated version of the mandate. The Denver Board of Water Commissioners adopted new water rates yesterday that will increase monthly water bills for customers serviced by Denver Water effective January 1st. According to Denver Water officials, the rate change will vary by location and will depend on how much water a customer uses. New rates are expected to increase a monthly bill by no more than $2 for a typical single-family residence. Denver Water indicates the rate hike will help to cover the cost of upgrades, maintenance, and repairs the utility anticipates will be needed over the next 10 years. Funding investments include the Gross Reservoir Expansion Project, the Lead Reduction Program, and a Cathodic Protection Program. The City of Longmont has won an award for an innovative biogas project. The city received the 2021 Water Environment Federation Project Excellence Award earlier this month, recognizing the city's efforts to utilize biogas produced from its wastewater treatment plant for use by 11 of the city's trash trucks that operate by compressed natural gas. According to the Longmont Leader, the award is given to projects executing infrastructural innovation in the water sector. Longmont began the renewable natural gas project in March of 2020 and has offset the use of nearly 100,000 gallons of diesel fuel a year, saving $300,000 in fuel costs and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by nearly 1,000 metric tons. The Longmont Leader also reports the city plans to replace its remaining 10 trash trucks with compressed natural gas vehicles by 2024. Today's weather along the Upper Metro Front Range includes sunny skies with highs reaching the low 60s. Fort Collins is expected to be breezy with wind gusts potentially reaching 23 miles per hour. Tonight, skies will be clear with lows in the upper 30s for Denver and Boulder and a low around 34 for Fort Collins. The current temperature outside the Boulder studios is 37 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Extended home confinement, remote work, and pandemic anxiety has caused many internet users to increase their daily doses of screen time since the start of the COVID crisis. For many, increased social media usage has increased exposure to mis- and disinformation. For more on this secondary effect of the pandemic, I spoke with Dr. Claire Wardle. She has a PhD in communications, a master's in political science, and is the co-founder and director of First Draft, a nonprofit that researches and addresses mis- and disinformation. I started our conversation by asking what some of the most important lessons have been for her in her 10-plus years of studying disinformation ecosystems.
I think one of the biggest lessons is that it evolves and changes. So the landscape looks very different today than it did in, for example, 2016, when a lot of what we saw was outright falsehoods. And, you know, we'd see a lot of that kind of content. But as the platforms have actually moved more aggressively against that, now we see much more misleading content. So we see different actors. A lot more of it is domestic now than foreign. So, yes, it is not a static environment.
What is the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
So disinformation is when people are deliberately creating false or misleading information with the whole purpose of creating harm. So this might be, for example, a Russian troll trying to derail an election in the US. That is very different to misinformation, which is when my mum sees something on Facebook, doesn't realize it's false, she's trying to be helpful and she reshares it. That's still false and misleading information, but she didn't realize that. She certainly didn't mean any harm.
So where does social media fit into this information ecosystem?
So as humans, we all always have liked to gossip and shared rumors that we might not have known was that were 100% true. But the difference now with social media is it's just supercharged that environment. So the thing that I whisper to my friend is now the thing that I share with 50 people who then share it with another 50 people, and then it travels very, very quickly. So it's supercharged a very human situation that we've always had a problem with misinformation, but we've just never had problems that spread so quickly that we couldn't control.
But when it comes to traditional media, we are operating under different rules. Like, for example, we can't engage in slander or libel, but there's a lot more space for that in social media. Why don't these platforms have to adhere to the same rules as traditional media?
So you're absolutely right that if you're a news outlet, then there are professional norms that you have to adhere to. When everybody suddenly got onto Facebook and had a smartphone in their hands, what they didn't realize was they were becoming publishers and that they had the same responsibility as you have. But you, if you make a mistake, which I'm sure you won't, you have a corrections policy. But on these social platforms, that doesn't exist. So the thing about the kind of in a space where social media has allowed a lot more voices to be heard, there are definite benefits to the internet and social media. The issue is, who is the arbiter of truth? So if on Facebook, my mum reshares something, should she be fined? In some countries, she might be put in prison. Now, in the US, the First Amendment, I mean, that doesn't happen. And the balance here is, how can we take the best bits of social media that allow all of these voices to be heard and all these voices to have a platform? But having that platform also means that sometimes people lie and they don't have to correct themselves. And that's the balance that we're currently going through. We're going through an information revolution. And we, as a society, are trying to figure this out. And unfortunately, there's no clear easy answers. We have to come up with them as a society about what we want these platforms to be and what we don't want them to be.
I want to go back to the balance that you speak about. Oftentimes in community media, those of us in editorial positions are accused of censorship when people aren't given unfettered access to the microphones or free hand to spread information that contradicts provable facts. What would you tell audiences about our responsibilities as people behind the microphones at community media outlets? What are our responsibilities to strike that balance between access and free speech?
So I think one of the reasons that we are where we are is that many people don't understand the ways in which journalists operate. People don't necessarily understand the fact that things have to be fact-checked, that there are editorial guidelines, that there are corrections policies. So many people will say, well, how are you any different with your microphone to a person over here who can just publish a podcast to Spotify? Isn't that the same thing? And that's because we haven't necessarily made people understand that you actually have professional norms that you have to live by. And I would argue that the internet means that everybody does have a microphone. That wasn't the case 30 years ago, but everybody does. But in terms of society operating in a way that people know who to trust, I would argue that the professional norms that you live by are critical for a functioning democracy, a functioning society. And that this idea that more information is good, a marketplace of ideas. Well, I would argue that it's not a free marketplace of ideas. Certain people can speak louder, certain algorithms privilege certain voices. That I think more speech is better, I don't think is always the case. And so I think everybody having a microphone, if we don't have systems and norms and processes, can lead to some of the problems we're seeing today.
What are some of the best practices that just everyday people who use these platforms should adhere to in order to not become a part of a disinformation ecosystem?
So in the same way as you wouldn't, you know, hit on air and say whatever was in the top of your head, the problem, because it's so easy for all of us to publish, you know, I can be standing in line waiting for a coffee. There's no consequence for me just sharing something without checking. The platforms are designed, they don't build any friction in because they don't want me to stop and think and be critical. They have made it very easy for all of us to share multiple times a day. Half of them can be right, half of them can be wrong, doesn't really matter. And so we all have kind of lost the idea that we need to be responsible for what we're sharing. So I would say to people, are you the best person to share that information about gargling salt water to prevent the virus? Are you a doctor? Have you been trained in that way? And I think because there's this kind of democratization of anybody can say anything, we should stop and be like, are you the best person to say that? Are you closest to the information? And to go back to who's got expertise, who's closest to the story, who would you trust, as opposed to the person who shouts loudest? So again, it's an evolution and we all are trying to figure this stuff out. But the one thing I say to anybody is do not share anything unless you are 100% positive that it's true. And if we were honest with ourselves, that's not always the case when we click share on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter.
Speaking about the platforms, there is a bit of a reward system that comes with sharing this information. The more sensational, the better. And then, of course, these built-in algorithms that just take you down these rabbit holes. What best practices would you recommend to these platforms to be able to kind of put the brakes on the spread of misinformation?
Well, we have the answers to this. We have research that shows that the more friction you build into the architecture of these platforms, the less misinformation gets shared. I mean, there's a researcher back in 2017, Nathan Matthias, who on Reddit just had this prompt that said, do you want to double check this before you share it? It significantly decreased the amount of misinformation being shared. So if the platforms had more labels, more heuristics, which are those mental shortcuts that said, well, actually, Russia Today, that is a state-sponsored media outlet. The more labels they have, the more explanatory context they have to any post, the more friction they build in. So before they share it, you share it, it says, we see that you haven't read this first. Are you sure you want to share it? That works. We know that it works. But the platforms also know that the more friction they build in, the less time we're going to spend on the platform and the fewer eyeballs on the advertisements. So there's an incentive here for us to not have friction and to share as much misinformation as we want.
In your studies of disinformation, have you found any common threads or traits among those who are most susceptible to believing falsehoods?
People who are frightened. And right now, the world is a pretty frightening place. So as humans, we have very powerful brains. But unfortunately, when we are frightened or scared or angry, it means that we're less likely to kind of use the critical functions in our brains. So those who are trying to manipulate us are more likely to create content deliberately designed to make us scared. And so in the last 10 to 15 years, many people have got increased economic insecurity. We've got a pandemic. The world looks very different. And so in that environment, people want kind of a foundation. They want simple explanations. Well, you know what's a simple explanation? A conspiracy theory. So people are vulnerable. They feel less connected to their communities. There are more people who are, we know this. Fewer people are connecting to their community, living alone. And in those environments, these online conspiracy spaces provide that explanation. They provide that community in a world that feels increasingly out of control and scary.
Claire Wardle, anything else that you would like to add that I didn't touch on with my questions?
I think it's one of the biggest challenges is that this is actually about emotion and psychology. Many people think it's about the content and it's about more facts. But actually, the more that people kind of learn emotional skepticism, so if you see something and it makes your heart race, it makes you angry, it makes you want to reshare to show that you were right all along, that's what we have to get better at measuring. Because when we're like that, then we're all very, very vulnerable. It doesn't matter what political partisanship you are, how educated you are, we're all very, very human when it comes to information and emotion.
I've been speaking with Dr. Claire Wardle, co-founder and director of First Draft, a nonprofit that researches and addresses mis and disinformation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. And before we get into Radio Nibbles, I have a special call out to the audience. I'll be guest hosting the Labor Exchange on Monday, and we'll be looking into the nuances of the so-called Great Resignation. Have you quit your job in the past year? Would you be willing to share your reasons why? Give us a call at our listener comment line. That number is 303-447-9911, and we'll play those messages back during the Labor Exchange. When you hear the sounds of Cab Calloway, you know what time it is. It's time for Radio Nibbles. And here in the studio with me, as always, is John Lindorf. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Shannon. God, what a gorgeous day in the Boulder Valley. Coming in this
beautiful
morning, I was just taken by the whole thing.
Oh, this whole fall. I've been so stunned by the palette of colors that you see.
I mean, I haven't really been trying very hard, but my morning glories are still alive on the patio. We have Halloween approaching in a few days, and it looks like it actually will be nice, and with the crunchy leaves and all that thing. So I wanted to talk about candy, pumpkins, and I've got a bunch of local food news.
Oh, well, fill us in.
You know, everybody's, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people are carving jack-o'-lanterns, which, by the way, are just lousy for making a pie. But that actually is a relatively recent thing in pumpkin history. About 100 years ago, most of the jack-o'-lanterns were actually turnips. They carved turnips and with very scary faces on them. And they must have had much bigger turnips. That's all I can say.
Well, you know what? It's interesting that you mentioned that, right? Because in Oaxaca, where I lived before moving here, every 23rd of December, it's something called the Noche de Rábanos, which is the Night of the Turnips. And there's this whole expo of carved turnips.
Really?
And it's not just like a single turnip. They make these whole like scenes, right? So it's like menageries of like carved turnips. It's a huge draw.
Well, a turnip upside down kind of looks like more like a head, you know. And the other thing I'd say about pumpkins and related gourds, you know, don't toss out the guts, you know. Wash off the seeds, salt them, oil them, put them on a baking sheet and have a snack.
Okay.
I also wanted to mention, so today's Nibbles column is I decided I would contact all the chefs and food people I knew and ask them to reminisce about Halloween candy. It makes great reading in the Boulder Weekly today because, you know, some of the chefs clearly had matured in their taste buds and their taste. But there were a few of them that, you know, they're still, you know, kids at heart, and they're still eating Swedish fish and Snickers and all that stuff. So it's a fun thing. The other thing I wanted to mention is that on Sunday, on Halloween, I'll be hosting a candy tasting with the Inventing Room in Denver.
Oh, cool. So what's the, give us some more, for those of us who might not know where the Inventing Room is.
It's a wonderful North Denver shop with a brilliant chef who creates artisan candy from scratch, including marshmallow and cotton candy and lollipops and things. And so we do these mystery candy tastings that we guide people through that are themed. This one is themed to the Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh.
It allows my inner entertainer to come out.
Well, of course, the thing with candy, there are wrappers. And I know that you have one of your personal causes is the avoidance of food waste. Mm-hmm. What can people do to avoid candy wrappers?
Well, we got a note from Nude Foods Market, which is just up the street from KGNU, and they're collecting candy wrappers from anyone, and they promise to turn it into something useful, which is much better than tossing them in a landfill to sit there forever.
And what are some of the flavors of candy that you that will be at the tasting? You just left me with my imagination hanging.
Well, I can't tell you because it's a magical mystery taste tour. People taste it and then they have to guess what the flavorings are. But I can tell you in the past that, you know, Ian will do things. This is Ian Kleiman, he'll do things like roasted butternut squash cotton candy. You know, that kind of thing. It's very. Or really, really sour lollipops, and you know, and it's all made from scratch.
Well, we're coming up on our time, so I'm going to ask you, what's the best thing you've tasted lately?
I think recently we talked about momo. Momo are wonderful Tibetan and Indian dumplings. And I got a note from a friend who said, you know, there's a new momo cart on the mall. And so I went down. Cherry's Momo Delights. It's right next to the information booth in front of the courthouse. They do wonderful momos. It just made me reminisce because in 1976, when I first arrived in Boulder and the mall was being built, I had a cart on the opposite end of that block selling sandwiches and salads to. Well, there wasn't anyone there because the mall hadn't been built, but it was a nostalgic moment.
Okay, well, you can read John's Nibbles columns at boulderweekly.com and listen to archive shows at kgnu.org. Thank you for coming in, John.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
And that does it for today's Morning Magazine here on listener-supported community radio. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, and John Lindor for their contributions to today's program. And thank you for spending your morning with us. A reminder that if you want to share your story about why you quit your job in the past year, I'm guest hosting the Labor Exchange on Monday. Give us a call and leave a message at our comment line, 303-447-9911. I'll include those comments in Monday's Labor Exchange program. Stay tuned for A Public Affair with Tish Buford and then Radio Book Club. But first, these news headlines from the BBC.